welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to one of the authors of Populism, A Very Short Introduction. The book was published by Oxford University Press, and I have the real pleasure today to talk to the one of the authors, Cass Muda. Cass, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I know that you've been very, very productive. We have the chance to talk about one of your new books, but it relates, I'm sure, to some of the other stuff that you're working on. Before we talk about the book, maybe you can just share a little bit about yourself and also your co-author.
Yeah, so I'm Cas Muda, and I'm a Dutch political scientist. Moved to the U.S. About 10 years ago and to the University of Georgia 5 years ago, where I am an associate professor. And I've written the book together with my friend Cristobal Rovira Kaltwasser, who is an associate professor at Diego Portales in Santiago in Chile.
Wonderful. And the book is, I imagine, part of a, I don't know how new the series is, but it's a series focused on explaining important contentious concepts, and populism certainly is one of those. It's such a confusing term because it's really used so variously, and you really start the book with that. I wonder if you'd start our conversation by describing a few of the more common and contradictory uses of the term that get to why it's hard to know exactly what someone means when they say populism.
Yeah, so in the U.S., traditionally, there are two interpretations of populism, and one is very specific and goes back to pretty much the first populist movement, the agrarian populist and the People's Party of the mid-19th century to beginning of the 20th century. And that really limits it to mostly an agrarian movement and, in many interpretations, kind of a positive movement that had progressive ideals. That is not very useful outside of that specific context. The other interpretation that's very popular still in the media and also particularly among economists is that populism is a kind of redistributive politics, which is, because most economists are neoliberal, bad, and leads to overspending. In Europe, populism is quite often seen more as demagogy, as kind of like promising everything to everyone, or to being folksy. And by and large, the problem with that interpretation is that the argument that that populists are politicians who speak in simple terms who try to act as if they're one of the people, or who overpromise, is problematic, because in today's campaigns, almost everyone does that.
Now, you offer another way to think about populism and to clarify and to offer something that is slightly more generalizable. You argue for an ideational approach and populism as what you describe, a thin-centered ideology. What do you mean by that exactly? And how does this clarify some of the important aspects of what populism is and also is not?
So the ideational approach broader means that populism is first and foremost seen as a set of ideas. And so it is not a way to mobilize. It is not necessarily about a leadership structure or things like that. But then within that, there are some people who say, well, it's more just a discourse I think that it is more than just a discourse. It actually also informs the way that these politicians see politics, but it is a relatively limited view on society and on politics. And that's why I call it thin-centered. Thin-centered means that it is by and large an ideology that speaks only to part of the broader program. And in this specific case of populism, it really just looks at society and distinguishes between two groups, which it claims to be homogeneous and antagonistic. And that is the pure people on the one hand and the corrupt elite on the other. And it wants politics to be the expression of what it considers the general will of the people. And so let me pick out a few points there. The most important ones are that the two groups are homogeneous, which means that all elite are corrupt, and it means that all people are pure. The second important thing, which is sometimes underplayed, is that the distinction is moral. It is between the pure and the corrupt. It's not between the rich and the poor. It's not class. It's not interest. It's morals. And the direct consequence of that is that compromise becomes extremely difficult, because when the pure make a compromise with the corrupt, then the pure are corrupted. That all said, it means that they see society as a struggle between those two groups. But when they are actually empowered, that populism itself doesn't tell them necessarily what the best economic system is, or whether they should have a welfare state, or even whether they should have a presidential or a parliamentary system.
Now in the U.S., which you talk about, not exclusively, but you group both the Tea Party and also Occupy Wall Street together as forms of populism. I wonder if you could talk about what they share, and also why we continue to see the Tea Party as a part of the political conversation, but not so much Occupy.
Well, what they share is that division between the pure people and the corrupt elite. And the Tea Party had, like, the corrupt elite was pretty much the Democrats and the Rhinos, the Republicans in name only. And it defended, like, the American people who allegedly don't want big government and socialism and those kind of things. Occupy Wall Street spoke about the 99% versus the 1%. And so two groups in which the 99% was homogeneous and was also kind of pure, whereas the 1% was corrupt. They weren't just rich, but they were, in a sense, evil, and they conspired against the people. And when you look actually at particularly grassroots Tea Party, which I think many liberals have always kind of ignored or minimized, and have always seen the Tea Party as mainly an astroturf phenomenon run by Americans for Prosperity and those kind of things. But when you actually went to the meetings, and I went to various meetings in Indiana, for example, you would see quite a lot of similar rhetoric to Occupy Wall Street, which I also visited. And it was much more populist, and it was much more about the regular people. Now, why do we still talk about the Tea Party and not about Occupy Wall Street? I mean, first of all, I think we talk way too little about the Tea Party, because I think the Tea Party was crucial to understanding the rise of Trump. But the Tea Party actually still exists in some form at the local and state level. Occupy Wall Street has just completely imploded. A few years back, I was at Occupy Radio, which is in Eugene, Oregon. And I asked the person who runs it, like, so are you the official radio station? And he said, yeah, I by and large just got the rights to that because no one does anything with it anymore. And that has a lot to do with infrastructure. It has to do with choices about whether you're going to create a real organization or not. But the sad part of it is that Occupy Wall Street has left very little in, I would say, organizational legacy.
Now, this also relates to leadership and actually having power. And as you describe, populism in Europe and elsewhere has taken on different forms, but has some peculiar similarities. And for example, as you note in the book, you want to wonder, why did populist leaders seem to buy soccer teams at such a high rate? This is both humorous, but also says something. Is that true? And does it matter? Is this simply an artifact of populists having money, or populist leaders having money, or is it something else? Does it express something interesting about when populists gain power?
Yeah, I think so. And it's not unique to populists. There are also non-populist leaders who buy football teams or other very popular sports teams. And I just watched a phenomenal documentary called Forever Pure, which is about the Israeli soccer team, Beitar Jerusalem, which was bought for a while by a guy who had no interest whatsoever in football. But he wanted to become the mayor of Jerusalem. And so he thought, if I buy the team, then all the fans of the team will vote for me and I will become mayor. And he actually lost the mayor race and then pretty much sold the team. But for populists, particularly very rich populists, like it is a little bit more difficult to share, to kind of argue that you're a man of the people. So if you have someone like Silvio Berlusconi, who was one of the richest men in Italy, who lived in opulence, then the connection between his life and that of the people could be a bit more difficult to sell. But he became the owner of AC Milan, which is one of the biggest soccer teams. And that made him a soccer man. And given that soccer is by far the most popular sport in Italy, that kind of made him much more one of the people. And so in that sense, soccer in most countries is by far the most popular sport. It's also a sport not really associated so strongly with class. And so it is not just working class. It's really the sport of the people.
Now, Donald Trump also owned a football team, a U.S. football team, for a while as well. Your book precedes his presidency by a little. It sort of seems, at least in its writing. But I wonder if you could talk about how he fits into your understanding of populism. In which ways is he a conventional populist leader, or is he unconventional in some ways?
Yeah, I think most of the pushback we have gotten so far about the book is that we talk too little about Brexit and about Trump. And in part, I think that that critique reflects a little bit more the parochialism of Americans and American scholars who are only interested in the rest of the world if you can link it to the US. But it's also understandable. Now, our book doesn't precede the rise of Donald Trump, but I would argue it precedes the transformation of Trump into a populist political actor. And what I mean by that is that in the, I would say, roughly the first year of his campaign, Trump did not campaign as a populist. I sat through a couple of his speeches at the really beginning where he really only talked about himself and at times a little bit the wall. And so he would go on these rants about how successful he was as a business and how he just sold like an apartment for several million to the Chinese. And then pretty much always said, like, I am the only one who can fix this. Right? He wasn't the voice of the people. And that changed pretty much when Steve Bannon took over his campaign mid-2016. And then you saw a transformation. Trump was increasingly describing his campaign as a movement. The epic inaugural speech was the pinnacle of that populist moment. Speech, of course, written by Stephen Miller in part and by Steve Bannon, where by and large he just said, having elected me as president, you have put the people in the White House. And so I think that Donald Trump is not a populist at heart. He has made that very clear in pretty much everything he has said. But he has made his movement and his presidency into a populist movement. The question is, how long will that remain now that Steve Bannon is out? He is increasingly moving to kind of a more hardcore Republican kind of deregulation part. It will be more difficult to square, but over the last year, he has still campaigned mostly as a populist.
Now, that does raise a final part here that we haven't talked much about, which is populism related to political parties. This is particularly important when we look at Europe and outside of the United States. How do populists fit themselves into political parties, given part of the populist symbolism is about outsiderness and not having power and taking power? What happens when populists become associated with political parties?
Well, in Europe, almost every country has a multi-party system, which means that there are at least four or five parties around. And being a political party is not necessarily being an insider. Particularly populist radical right parties like Front National of Marine Le Pen in France have been outsider parties. They've never been in government. And so it is not that problematic to be associated with a party, because that is just how politics is done. What tends to be more challenging is when populists come to power. And there has been for quite a while this kind of received wisdom that populism is useful to get into power, but it becomes a problem once you're in power. And to a certain extent, that makes sense, right? Because that would mean that you become the elite. But we have more than enough examples that show that if you are a really crafty populist, you can still be in power and argue that there is still an elite out there that is trying to frustrate you. Now think, for example, about what Donald Trump is doing at the moment, where he's saying, like, I'm trying to do what the people want, right? But there's the courts that are against me, and there's the media that are against me. And in the broader field, like, of Trump supporters, they're talking about the deep state that is frustrating, like, is working against them. And so there's still this shadowy, corrupt elite. The problem is, how long can you maintain this? Because let's assume that you're in power for 10 years and you still argue that by and large you can't get anything done because of the strong, shady elite. I assume most voters are at that point in time starting to look for someone who is also populist, but more effective.
Now, the final thing that I wanted to talk about is the issue of gender, which comes up in an interesting way in the book. We've talked about a number of male populist leaders, and also masculinity as a part of populism. Would you talk a little bit about that dimension of populism? Because there are also examples of women populist leaders, but it doesn't fit into, I think, some of the ways that we think about populism. So how do those two things fit together?
Yeah, I really think that the gender dimension of populism still needs a lot of work. Like in the related field of kind of the radical right, we have a little bit more on it, but it's actually more interesting for populism because populism is not only on the right, and particularly in Latin America. When we think about populists, we think almost exclusively about men. And very much about masculinity. But intrinsically, there's nothing gendered about populism because, again, it's such a thin ideology. And as a consequence, the connection between populism and gender goes mostly through the culture. And what that means is that the culture, to a large extent, sets the boundaries of what a woman can be. And so in traditional cultures, like as we see, for example, in Southeast Asia, women can actually be leaders, can be presidents, but they have to be kind of the wife of or the daughter of an important male man. Whereas in Northern Europe, which has as equal and emancipated a culture as you can have, women don't have to abide by these kind of rules. Now, where gender plays an interesting role is how populist leaders, female populist leaders, of which there are quite a lot, how they use it. And so take, for example, Sarah Palin, who, to a certain extent, has not been taken serious that much, but there are some interesting aspects to it. She comes up within as a clearly a populist, supported by the Tea Party, but also within a very old-fashioned and traditional gender role culture of conservatism in the US. And so how does she frame herself as like a Mama Grizzly, right? Because the mother is an acceptable part. But what helps her is that in a conservative kind of culture, women are outsiders in politics. Like just by their gender, they're seen as not traditional politicians. And so in more conservative cultures, being a woman actually helps you as a populist because it makes you, by gender, an outsider.
Yeah, the book is so interesting and I think hits on these issues and I think likely relate to some other things that you're working on. Before we finish, I wonder if you can just briefly mention the other book that you have out on the right-wing politics. I think that's a recent one. Could you give us a little hint of that work?
Yeah, I have a couple of books out. I mean, mostly I have about 3 books out, which are largely collections of op-ed pieces and interviews that I've given. One is about the left-wing populist party Syriza in Greece and the role they played in the crisis. And one is a bit broader. It's on extremism and democracy in Europe, where I speak about far-right politics, populist politics, liberal democracy, and terrorism and counter-terrorism. And then I have, this year, I have a new book out about the far-right in the U.S., which is mostly trying to put it in a more historical perspective, to argue that Trump is not just some aberration, but is actually in line of pretty much 2 centuries of nativism, as well as very closely related to the Tea Party, which was only about 10 years ago. And I'm now trying to move a little bit away from writing so much about populism, and I'm working on partly on some work, maybe articles, books, on the transformation of European politics more broadly, and particularly the link between the rise of populism and the decline of social democracy.
Yeah, I hope you come back with this work in the future. And until then, the current book that Cast has written with Cristobal is Populism, A Very Short Introduction, published by Oxford University Press. Cast, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me here.